Good morning. A week from Saturday, voters in the city and county of Honolulu will make their choice for mayor. Charles Zhu is a challenger for that office, and we'll sit down with him for an extended conversation later this hour. First, we'll get an analysis of this week in politics from Neil Conan. I'm Beth Ann Koslovich.
And I'm Chris Vanderkirk. Filmmaker Will Allen has created an intimate documentary about life inside a cult based on his 22 years under the spell of a charismatic leader who repaid devotion with abuse. His movie is called Holy Hell.
That's one of the conversations we'll have coming up this hour. It's Tuesday, August 2nd. Stay here for all the conversation coming up after this news.
Good morning and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Chris Vanderkirk. Good morning, Beth Ann.
Good morning.
100 days or give or take till the election and the battle is joined, yeah?
Well, this is true, and we're going to talk more about that this morning at a little bit different time in the program.
Yeah.
But you know that with both political party conventions now over, there are now, as you say, 2 months before the first presidential debate, 3 months before the election. Opinion polls show that Hillary Clinton bounced back into the lead after the Democratic convention, while Donald Trump battles the parents of a war hero and struggles with the modern history of Ukraine. Politics is ever on the mind of news analyst Neil Conan, and he joins us now, as he does most Tuesdays, from his Macnut farm on the Big Island. Good morning.
Good morning. Nice to be in the lead for once.
Well, nice to have you here. Now, let's rewind a little bit. Back to Philadelphia and the Democratic Convention, it came off almost flawlessly, and those cries of dissent from Bernie Sanders supporters were, at the end, at least shouted down. We heard a series of really polished speeches. Was all this enough to boost Hillary Clinton?
As you suggested, the first set of poll numbers say it was. Let's rewind even further back. Secretary Clinton was up about 6 or 7 points back in June. That started to tumble after FBI Director James Comey's stinging remarks about her carelessness with her emails as Secretary of State. By the end of the Republican convention, Donald Trump had pulled even, maybe even ahead in some polls. Clinton seems to have had a solid bounce, though, up now between 3 and 9 points. Most experts want to wait a couple of 3 weeks before they see the numbers as being more reliable, though.
So there was no reason not to expect a post-convention bounce. That usually happens, as you reminded us a few weeks ago. And as we saw last week, the Democrats produced quite a spectacle.
Yes, indeed, and quite a comparison to the shambles the previous week in Cleveland. All the party's heavyweights spoke of Bill Clinton, of course, trying to humanize his wife. Both the president and the vice president, very good speeches, delegitimizing Donald Trump in, I think, extraordinary language. The candidate herself did okay, I think. She's never going to be the speaker Barack Obama is, but she was confident. You know, the most important part of an acceptance speech is to sell yourself as a credible president, to convince the audience that you can assume the role of commander-in-chief, and I think she pulled that off.
The speech, though, that everyone is still talking about, one that was all over social media, was from the father of Army Captain Khan, the Muslim-American soldier killed in Iraq.
And Donald Trump can't stop talking about it either. It's hard to believe that everybody has seen that speech by now, but if you missed it, Kaiser Khan excoriated Trump's anti-Muslim immigration policy. He said his family would never have been allowed into the country under that policy. He and his wife stood in front of a picture of their son in uniform. He said Trump had sacrificed nothing, knew nothing about liberty and equal protection under the law, and reached into his pocket and offered to lend Trump his copy of the Constitution. It was devastating.
Some viewers might have missed that because, you know, for example, Fox News didn't carry it. But as you mentioned, Donald Trump can't seem to let go. He said that Kaiser Khan had no right to attack him. He said that he and his wife had not been allowed to speak, and when he finally got around to calling their son a hero, he still tried to link that to terrorism.
And, you know, despicably, some of his allies, like Roger Stone, are smearing the Khan family as secret agents of the Muslim Brotherhood, for which there is no evidence whatsoever.
All of this, though, is really keeping this story alive.
And just contrast that with what Secretary Clinton said after the emotional speech at the Republican convention when Patricia Smith said she blamed Clinton personally for the death of her son, Sean, in Benghazi. Secretary Clinton didn't argue with her on the facts, which she could have. She just empathized with her heartbreak and honored her son. And if you remember, that's exactly what President Bush did when he had to deal with Cindy Sheehan in the Iraq War. You just don't attack the families of dead soldiers, not for any number of reasons, but high on that list is that it's terrible politics.
Yet again, though, this is one of those moments that has to raise questions for Speaker Paul Ryan, Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, other Republican officials. And we've seen a lot of statements of sympathy for the con, some denunciations of the candidate, but so far they all still say they support him.
One exception, Richard Hanna, a retiring congressman for upstate New York. This incident with the cons was, I don't think this had happened last week when we talked. That was after Trump encouraged the Russians to find the missing emails, in other words, invited a foreign power to hack the U.S. government.
He said, though, that he was just being sarcastic.
Well, he got around to that explanation after 3 days. Just joking, folks.
Okay, but it goes to another unforced error, the one when Trump told George Stephanopoulos on ABC this past Sunday that under President Trump, Russia would never go into Ukraine, even though Russia annexed part of Ukraine a couple of years ago, the Crimea, and it continues to wage a low-level war in eastern Ukraine.
And at the same time, he's trying to sound tough on Russia on ABC. At his rallies, he continues to praise Putin. He says it would be much better for us to have good relations with Russia and continues to say NATO is obsolete, which, as you can imagine, causes considerable anxiety in Europe and a lot of heartburn for the vast majority of Republican foreign policy types who believe no such thing.
I want to go back to something you said a little earlier, though, about the effort by President Obama and other speakers at the DNC to delegitimize Donald Trump. Isn't that what the Republicans are also trying to do?
Yes. That comes capsulized in the crooked Hillary nickname and the lock her up chant. President Obama, Vice President Biden, and Clinton herself all said this election is not about standard politics. It's not about Republican and Democrat, not about left and right, but about a dangerous demagogue, in contrast to, if you remember, Michael Bloomberg's memorable phrase, a candidate who's competent and sane. President Obama said it again today at the joint news conference at the White House with Prime Minister Lee of Singapore. And at the convention, remember, he said Trump wasn't conservative, he wasn't a Republican. Today he called on Republicans to repudiate him. Now, all of this attack line may ring true with some independents and with some Republicans. On the other hand, crooked Hillary may sway some Democrats, but it also means that whoever wins this election is going to take office delegitimized in the eyes of a considerable fraction of the country. A lot of Republicans never did accept legitimacy of Barack Obama, and as we saw, it made governing more difficult. But even more importantly, and into yet another presidential term, this is corrosive. It eats away at democracy, at our faith in democracy.
That's a troubling assessment. Now, before we let you go, though, I want to ask you about one more thing. As I mentioned at the top, it's 2 months to the presidential debate. Isn't his campaign raising questions about all that?
Yes, indeed. Now, the first two presidential debates are scheduled for nights when NFL football games are also on TV. Now, the commission that runs the debates is nonpartisan. They issued this schedule back in January, so it shouldn't come as any surprise at this point. But Trump says, he suspects that this committee's in cahoots with the Democrats, the same way the DNC tipped the scales for Clinton back in the primaries. And it's another example, he says, of how the system is rigged against him. And, of course, that makes some Democrats wonder whether he just wants to duck a one-on-one debate with Hillary Clinton, which is a format that Secretary Clinton does pretty well in.
You said one-on-one debate. What about the Libertarian Party and the Green Party? Seems to be getting a lot more attention this year.
They are, but the debate commission sets a threshold of 15% support in major polls. If you remember all the way back to 1992, that's how Ross Perot got on the stage with H.W. Bush and with Bill Clinton. Now, Jill Stein of the Green Party is polling at about 2% right at the moment. Gary Johnson, who's the Libertarian candidate, is polling about 9 or 10%. Now, that is better than libertarians have done in the past, better than Gary Johnson himself did 4 years ago. But neither of these parties has much money, so they're going to have difficulty running ads on TVs. And neither of these parties has the kind of structure to mount a serious challenge, at least not right now.
All right. Well, until next week, we're going to leave it there.
You bet, Beth Ann.
Thanks very much, Neil. News analyst Neil Conan joins us most Tuesdays from the farm. You can also hear his Pacific News Minutes right here on Hawaii Public Radio.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the Scheidler Family Foundation in support of the Honolulu Museum of Art, presenting the Chinese mural artist Hua Tunan, painting live at the museum August 2nd through 5th. HonoluluMuseum.org.
This is The Conversation on statewide, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. It's now 8:16. Coming up, analyzing the strange power of a cult leader. But first, your backyard quiz.
The issue of rail is front and center for voters on Oahu this election season. And although Oahu is the only island currently grappling with issues about rail, the entire Hawaiian archipelago has a rich history when it comes to locomotive transport. The first rail line in Hawaii was built in 1881 for the purpose of hauling sugarcane. The rest of the kingdom soon followed suit. By 1899, industrial rail lines had been built on Kauai, Oahu, Maui, and Hawaii Island. Most were used to haul sugarcane, but some also moved freight and passengers. The heyday of commercial rail in Hawaii lasted more than 50 years, but it came from humble beginnings. From today's backyard quiz, we want to know what was the first railway to operate in Hawaii. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. And the first one to get it right gets the T-shirt. Will Allen gave two decades of his life to a Los Angeles-based cult and to its charismatic leader. What began as a journey toward personal growth turned into a life of subjugation, one from which he could not free himself. His life in the cult and his eventual escape became a documentary film called Holy Hell that he's bringing to the Honolulu Museum of Art's 27th Annual Honolulu Rainbow Film Festival. We talked with him about it yesterday.
I try to tell my personal story and combine it with my friends who also took the same journey with me. And mine started, you know, in 1985 when my sister introduced me to this group of people who were meditating. It's very simple. It's very healthy. And they had a teacher, which was very new to me. And we all ended up bonding together and going through these really deep experiences together. And we ended up becoming like a family with this guru teacher who was feeding us with many healthy teachings at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And the story covers our journey together over 20 years. We ended up staying together much of the time. We didn't want to, but we stayed. And so it kind of explores how people get into things like this, how they give their life over to it, why they stay, why they can't get out, and what's really going on behind all of it.
You started out in an atmosphere of freedom, right? Feeling that this was, you were there by choice and you were, mm-hmm. It was an interesting and valuable experience for you. And then gradually, sounds like you got kind of ensnared by the
Yeah, we got overpowered. I believe when I look back on it, you know, I started to adapt the teachings that were being said, and he was very pushy, and he would tell us, you know, this is what you're looking for. You're looking for this one experience, and I have it.
He, the leader. I'm sorry.
He, the teacher. Yeah, we had a guru type figure mm-hmm. who was the teacher, who was, you know, pretty much self-proclaimed guru. But at the time in the 80s, we really didn't have any way to compare it to anything else. I think we just all kind of went on this real fervent spiritual journey that really had no end. It was this enlightenment, and it was something you constantly had to work on every day. And so we stayed every day to work on it, and it turned into years.
For somebody who ends up making a documentary, you were in a pretty enviable position because you were shooting all this, right?
Well, I was enviable because I lived with the teacher for 18 years.
Yeah.
I took care of him, chauffeur, masseur, all these things. And so at the beginning, that was an enviable position.
Mm-hmm.
Eventually, nobody wanted that job, you know, because they saw how hard it was and how nasty he could be.
Yeah.
But, yes, I started making movies after a year or so because I'd never seen anything like this before. I'd never seen people experiencing this kind of vulnerability and freedom and joy, and I was really in love with my friends, and I was in love with my teacher, and so I started to document our life together, only for ourselves, never thinking I would ever show it to anybody necessarily, because we were kind of isolated from society, and we weren't really part of the society around us anymore. It was just our group. So, I made movies for a long time, for 20 years, and I started making short films and narrative films because I was a filmmaker at heart.
When and you found yourself living a subject, when did it sort of begin to sour, and why was it difficult to get out of by that point?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It soured early on for me, which is really shocking. You know, my experience soured early, but I was really committed and loyal to the whole concept that we were doing and helping people. So I stayed committed and was long-suffering. And I found out when I interviewed people, a lot of people were long-suffering. Like, they would ignore their feelings and keep pushing forward and let abusive things happen to them and not object. And that's interesting, isn't it? I mean, why do we do that as human beings? Why do we stay in something that's hurtful?
Of course, Will, you immediately made me think of abusive relationships.
Yeah. It's very similar. There's not much difference how women or men stay in abusive relationships in spite of their suffering.
Part of it is that it's the only world they know after a certain point, right?
That's right. And they don't want to lose the good. And they get codependent. And they get forgiving. And, oh, it's not always like that. And sometimes it is. But those abuses are deep. And they're psychic. I mean, they're into your psyche. And those are deep scars that you're earning during that period, and you're also ignoring.
The central figure, Michelle, I'm just looking at a couple of pictures of him, was clearly, you know, charismatic, physically attractive, right?
Something so.
What was the appeal?
Well, he was probably, at the time in my life, he was my mentor. He was the first person I met that looked like he was already in his 40s and happy or joyful and had the understanding of the mystery of life and was funny, cultured, intelligent. And so he was like, I went from college to this, what I found to be like another teacher, like a teacher about life. And he was an actor, an ex-actor, so he was very creative. He had done acting workshops before I met him. So he kept us all very entertained. We worked on our ego through acting techniques. We went to the movies. We did things that were creative, and it kept us all very distracted and entertained. So we had a very fun life. And he was the catalyst for that. I have to give him credit for that back in the day. But that all soured and became very old and manipulated and, you know, controlling and stuff like that.
You know, Will, in controlling relationships, you sometimes hear of the phenomenon of what they call intermittent reinforcement.
Yes.
You know, right, where it comes from behavioral science, where the rat, if you keep pressing the bar, you get fed every once in a while, but you never know when, right?
That's right. Oh, my God, that's so well put.
So the slap, you either get a slap or a kiss, but you don't know when it's going to be.
Yeah, we called it a kick and a cuddle.
But that's where the hook gets in, doesn't it?
It is, because when you would have those good experiences, they were so good, and they usually surrounded, they usually were with yourself in meditation or with your friends in your group. Mm-hmm. You'd have these really deep experiences, and none of the bad stuff was present, and none of it mattered anymore. And so you got that piece of cheese, you know, you got that moment of cheese and that reinforcement that this is why I'm here,
mm-hmm.
you know, for this moment.
You know, it strikes me, Will, there are lots of insights in this movie about just how the mind works, how relationships work, even mm-hmm. beyond the story of a cult. You think that's accurate?
I do think that's accurate. I'm really very pleased with that because as odd as our group was, you know, we don't want people to miss the human nature that we all have. Mm-hmm. And it really is about everyone, you know, because we were smart people, smart enough and educated. And I feel like we went through a very long, tumultuous, bad relationship, abusive relationship. Yeah.
How are you doing now?
Well, I'm good. I mean, I'm just human. You know, I'm still human. We have every day. Every day is a choice. And I have great days and, you know, days that are harder. But overall, you know, it's been an amazing journey to make the film. Sitting with the footage for 2 to 3 to 4 years was not fun. Trying to listen to my friends' stories that were painful was not fun, and remembering mine. But it's all a healing process. You know, where you place it, you leave it where it was, and you learn from it, and you move on.
Will Allen is the director of Holy Hell, which will be shown at the Honolulu Museum of Art's 27th Annual Honolulu Rainbow Film Festival in the Doris Duke Theater on Friday, August 19th.
Complete with a legend who used his superpowers to change the world.
We do not want our freedom gradually, but we want to be free now.
Better than the X-Men, John Lewis and his graphic novel trilogy, March, next time on The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International.
This morning at 9, right after The Conversation.
Where does Hiko go from here? With the next era deal over, that question is getting some answers from Hiko's president, Alan Oshima, and it's the basis for the last in the Civil Beat series, Electric Dreams. Reporter Chad Blair, laughing right there, joins us now with a reality check of the future, at least of Hiko, potentially. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann. And yes, it is for sure this time the last in the installment of Electric Dreams, Eric Pape's terrific series on the Hawaiian electric history.
And not that we haven't enjoyed it, but simply we thought yesterday was going to be the last one. So
understood.
Looking at this one, you know, going forward, you know, Hiko's history, as we've talked about through all the parts of the series, both mirrored and shaped modern Hawaii history. But making it a modern company, well, that's a little different when you're talking about, you know, the 21st century context. Many companies know the maxim, change or die. Last week, when Alan Oshima was here with us, he seemed really over the next era deal and focused on other projects, including the solar project with the Navy. Where do you think Hiko is now?
Well, you know, in many ways, it's been a two-year timeout while this next era merger deal was going through the Public Utilities Commission. Obviously, that did not go through, and NextEra has left the market, and Hawaiian Electric is continuing pretty much as it was. But the way Oshima described it to Eric is that in many ways it's been a learning process for the company. They've, in particular, had to learn more about the regulatory process with the PUC. They think they've come up with ways to make Hawaiian Electric more efficient and a more modern company. As you know, its origins date to the late 19th century. Oshima mentioned a sort of operating mode that NextEra follows, an internal culture of perpetual movement, meaning you can't just sit there. You really need to be constantly trying to make things better and look for new opportunities. So the way he describes it is a company going forward, Hawaiian Electric, still dedicated to 100% renewable by 2045. As you know, that's the state's mandate. But all in all, ready to move, leave the NextEra situation behind them and look to the future.
Some will hear what you just said about Aonoshima Processing, how NextEra does business, always moving forward, always trying to make things a little better and more efficient, as saying, well, maybe that's a lesson that's come a little bit too late, but at least it's a lesson that's come. At this point, is there any indication of a change of structure or strategy in terms of HECO's transformation?
The way he described it is the company's in an exploration process. They're really trying to learn what's the best thing to do. Technology has a heck of a lot to do with this. Will there be storage batteries large enough to handle, you know, large-scale electric storage? You have them for homes, but not for power companies. Will more people buy electric vehicles? That will certainly help more as well. And, of course, we've talked about the smart grid technology, having a system that basically allows the company to understand its customers better, to communicate with them. But that's probably still 3 to 5 years off at minimum. But there's a sense that going forward, they are going to have to take on these new technologies and really transform their infrastructure.
And we're going to watch that transformation, and heaven knows we will be talking about it. Thanks, Chad. Talk to you in the morning.
Thanks. Yeah.
Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair joins us every day with a reality check.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the National Kidney Foundation of Hawaii, striving to increase awareness and treatment of kidney diseases affecting 1 in 7 Hawaii residents. Learn more at kidneyhi.org.
In 11 days, voters in the city and county of Honolulu will make their selection for mayor. Whether that's the incumbent or one of the challengers comes down to which of the candidates can get the 51% majority in the primary, or if not, which two top candidates will face each other in November. In either scenario, Charles DeJoux would like to be Honolulu's next mayor, and today in our series of conversations with the top three candidates, we pick up with a sit-down with Charles DeJoux. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you very much for having me on your show.
Thanks very much for being here.
And yes, if I could remind all your listeners, election's only 11 days away, and walk-in voting started yesterday. So if you haven't cast your ballot via mail, please make sure you do so. And, you know, avoid the lines. Go into Honolulu Hale or Kapolei Hale between now and the 11th.
Whatever you do, just go
just
vote.
Just get out and vote. Yes, absolutely.
Right. Now, let's talk about some of the issues that we're all talking about this time around. Now, rail has run well over budget, over that, you know, 5.1 or 2 or whatever number you want to assign to it, around that figure. We hear that the cost of rail could exceed $8 billion, maybe even as much as $11 billion. Now, you've said that you wanted to contain the cost at the roughly $7 million already allocated for rail. You've also said that the city must, and these are your words, city must honor the commitment made to the people of the city and county of Honolulu to provide a mass transit solution from Kapolei to Ala Moana. But mass transit doesn't necessarily mean rail.
Yes, so that's correct.
So what do you mean?
You know, Bethann, several things here. First, you're absolutely right. This rail project is billions of dollars over budget, years behind schedule. I mean, it's just been incompetently handled and grossly mismanaged. What I believe that we need to do is, number one, we need new leadership. And that means not just replacing the executive director, Dan Grabauskas, but also the mayor. I mean, that's where the problem is. Number two, I believe that we need to cap our costs. And that means no more tax increases for every single time there's a cost overrun. We have to understand that the people have stepped up and done their share in stepping up and setting aside $7 billion of tax money. The government simply has not. We have grossly mismanaged this project. Number three, We have got to look at other alternatives here. And yes, some of those alternatives include putting the system on the ground. And it includes, yes, we should have a very serious discussion about whether or not we should be converting the system to a new high-technology bus system rather than a elevated heavy rail system based on 19th century, really, technology. But the point here is we cannot do the same thing. Beth-Ann, for me, what's so frustrating about this is that I think, you know, the mayor understands this project is way over budget. It is way behind schedule. The only really truly bad idea is to understand and recognize all of that and still say, stay the course, do nothing, just give people more of the same. That just simply does not make any sense to me.
In that phrase, mass transit isn't necessarily the word rapid. One of the points that was made with the rail was that it was going to be fast. But the criticism is that if you put it at grade, you can only go as fast as, you know, traffic will basically allow you to go. Mm-hmm. Plus, you take away traffic or space for car traffic.
Well, a couple of things here. First off, in terms of the transportation solutions and how we get there. But then if we have an unlimited amount of money, if money just completely grew on trees and we could do anything, well, we wouldn't be having this discussion. This really wouldn't be a serious topic of concern. But the reason we're having this discussion is because I don't want Honolulu to go down the same path as Puerto Rico, which is an island community like ours, based on tourism like ours, built a heavy rail system like us. But when their system started going way over budget, they adopted the spend-to-no-end mentality. And today, Puerto Rico, in part, is in bankruptcy because of that. I don't want Honolulu to go down that same path. So we got to find a solution, but one we can afford. Now, what can we afford? You're right. In terms of mass transit, I think several things that our community needs to understand is we need to be looking at putting on the grid at grade, which means on the ground, because that's a type of system that we can afford within the budget that the people have. Now, I also think here, especially if we go to a bus option, is that you can have and you can run multiple different buses here to multiple different areas. In other words, you can have one that goes straight to Ala Moana, one that goes straight to the University of Hawaii, rather than an at-grade system, which is confined to its rail and must stop at every location. You can actually perhaps go faster. Other options here that I think are worthy of exploration is that you give these buses an automatic green light, similar to what we give our ambulances and our fire trucks. As some of your listeners may understand, you know, whenever the ambulance turns on its siren, as they approach an intersection, if it's red, it automatically turns green for the ambulance or for the fire truck. It would be just adopting that same technology for these transit vehicles, albeit without the siren, so that they can get from one green light from Middle Street on to Ala Moana, one green light from Ala Moana on to downtown.
So I'm hearing you say that we're looking at, in your view, potentially trading speed for dollars that we don't have. In the interest of time, we're going to move on
sure.
to something
yep.
else. The average salary, or rather, I want to talk to you about this one first. Striking a balance between public health and safety and access to public areas mm-hmm. while providing substantive aid to Oahu's growing number of homeless people mm-hmm. continues to track a little differently with the city and at state levels.
Yep.
Despite current efforts, we know that homelessness on Oahu has appreciably increased. As you've been in municipal, state, and federal government, uh-huh. I'm looking at, I really want to know what factors you see that are contributing to this increase. If there are gaps in the approaches to the city and the state to help people out of homelessness, and equally as important, what factors you see that would help those at the margins from falling into homelessness?
Yes. You know, Beth-Ann, I wish I could say as a candidate for mayor, if you just adopted this one public policy, this one magic bullet, I could wipe out all homelessness in our community. The reality is I cannot. But you're absolutely right. It is a problem that has gotten worse and worse and worse over the last 4 years. And it's a problem that's just gone from bad to terrible. What I think we need to look at here is what are the main drivers that cause homelessness in our community? And from my vantage point, it's four things. It's mental illness. Second, drug abuse. Third, economic homelessness. And fourth and finally, a minority that have adopted it for whatever reason as a lifestyle. Each of these different drivers needs a different reaction from our government. And clearly what we're doing right now isn't working. For those who are mentally ill and with drug abuse, we need counseling. And we need to get them into mental health counseling or drug counseling. And the way I think we need to do that is not through the government.
What we need to be doing is not directing more government resources towards that. What we need to be doing is taking those resources and directing it to the nonprofit community, whether it's Salvation Army or IHS or Hina Mauka. I'm a big believer that the nonprofit community can deliver the same services much more effectively, reach more people more quickly than the government bureaucracy can, with all of our problems with procurement rules and civil service rules and regulations. Quickly, for those who are economically homeless, I do support low-income housing, but what I want to see is more turnover. And that is, in addition to building low-income housing, and that's always a challenge to build more low-income housing, is that we need more people who are in low-income housing to graduate to the next rung in the economic ladder, get out of low-income housing and into regular housing. So we free up that unit for somebody who is on the street for that low-income housing. And the way you do that, I think we got to find some creative programs to encourage individuals to save for a down payment, because that very frequently is the biggest challenge to get into regular housing. Last and finally is those who have chosen it as a lifestyle. And for those, I do believe in strict enforcement of the law. As a mayor, I will use the police force. Nobody has a right to take over a city park, beach, or sidewalk.
In all of this, what hasn't come out in a lot of the conversation is the issue of housing first. Mm-hmm. And how that fits into your view mm-hmm. of allowing nonprofits to do what they do. Mm-hmm. Several of them are doing it now.
Yes.
But considering that that connection between HUD and Housing First mm-hmm. is quite allied and doesn't appear to go anywhere mm-hmm. else but into a Housing First direction mm-hmm. soon, how do you see that playing into how, in general, Honolulu looks at housing when clearly we don't have enough of it?
Yes. Now, Housing First, for listeners who don't understand it, is that just to give individuals who are currently on the street some form of housing, initially at least, with no questions asked. Doesn't matter with whether you have a criminal history, drug abuse history, or whatnot.
Get them off the street, stabilize them in a housing situation, and then wraparound services.
And I think that's a good... it's a good step, and it's something that I do support. But obviously, what we're doing in Honolulu right now is not enough. We need to do a much better job of that. And again, that's why I emphasize here, working with the nonprofit community and integrating their counseling and services with resources, because it's the government which can provide the resources, I think that integration can be done, must be done far, far better. If I could also just quickly add here, the next rung behind homelessness is making sure that we have sufficient amount of affordable housing here in our community. I think you need a mayor who's going to be committed to building more housing on this island. It's a trickle-down effect here, and that is when housing prices, market prices, start separating significantly from affordability, what then happens is people who normally would be able to afford a home are dropping down and taking low-income housing. People are in low-income housing and then bumping out into the streets. That's something that a good mayor needs to be doing a much better, focusing in on more.
Well, let's talk about
that.
Let's talk about that a little bit, because the average salary in Honolulu Metro is $40,000, according mm-hmm. to Indeed.com. Forbes 2015 ranking shows Honolulu Metro with a median household income of little more than $75,000. Mm-hmm. For decades, the conversation about the need for affordable housing has continued. Many of the projects, though, that we currently see under construction don't really address the needs of that group. And it certainly was going to add to the infrastructure to, you know, make us have to pay a little bit more to make that work, too. Now, because all of this looks to be reasonably unaffordable for families making, say, $40,000 to $75,000, mm-hmm. let alone for people near or at homelessness, what do you think has to happen to incentivize developers to build what Honolulu Metro needs, despite price points that likely won't translate into higher profits for those companies?
Bethann, what we need is a mayor who understands the market, understands what's going on here in construction and development. Let me just briefly explain. We have 950,000 people here on the island of Oahu. Now, approximately, our population grows by roughly 10,000 people a year, according to the U.S. Census. What does that mean, according to the Department of Housing and Urban Development? Means if you add 10,000 people to your population, you need to be adding about 3,000 to 3,500 housing units to this island every single year. Because if you do not, what happens here is demand will start very quickly outstripping supply. Then market rates start getting far, far away from affordability rates. So you need a mayor who's going to be committed to understanding this basic market dynamic here about population growth and the need to build more housing here on this island to prevent the separation of market and affordability. But
right. But
the trick here is now this is a big difference. If I were seeking the mayorship of Phoenix or Dallas or Las Vegas, the way most mayors fix this problem is you go out in the desert, you condemn, 1,000 acres of desert land and slap a couple subdivisions on it and boom, you're done. Easy. I have a twin policy goal, and that is I don't want to pave over yet another beautiful native Hawaiian valley. I don't want every single square inch of this beautiful island paved over in asphalt, because I have these twin goals here now, recognizing, number one, that I want to make housing affordable and recognize I need to provide 3,000-plus housing units to the community every year. But I have this simultaneous goal of not wanting to pave over all of our island in asphalt. How do we fit that in together? For me, if I'm elected mayor, what I believe that we do need to do is we need to look at increasing height limits. We do need to look at urban infill. We need to look at encouraging more development in the urban core so we both are able to achieve the objective of getting more housing in, but also the objective of not paving over paradise. The easy thing, unfortunately, what has been done for the longest period of time is nothing. Is you don't look at affordable housing, you then don't want any more development here, and you just let market rates get way, way out of whack from affordability rates, and then you are left with what we're left with here is just no affordable housing, and people are unable to live here.
But clearly from what you've just said and from what many of us have seen happen over time, we are well behind the curve.
Oh, yes.
And we're going to stay that way for most likely the foreseeable future. Now, let's move to another issue.
Oh, sure.
Public trust in government and in municipal positions of power continues to erode.
Mm-hmm.
That includes public trust in police departments. And while mm-hmm. Honolulu has thus far not had the kind of public violence that we've seen other mm-hmm. places to make that point, the investigation of HPD's chief, the lack of records concerning officers punished or removed for misconduct, and the fact that Hawaii is the only state in the nation without a police standards training board, all continue to foster calls for police reform. So how much police reform are you committed to?
Well, several things, Bethan. You're absolutely right. Public integrity is extraordinarily important. I mean, that's why I'm very disturbed that the mayor has basically eviscerated the Ethics Commission when they started asking the quote-unquote wrong questions about the mayor's fundraising. I'm concerned about the mayor taking two jobs in addition to taking a $165,000 a year salary as mayor, also taking a $200,000 a year salary at a local bank. And in terms of the police department, yes, I am very concerned here about the chief and his ethics. If Chief Kealoha were just Sergeant Kealoha or Officer Kealoha, what he was going through right now, I think I'd perfectly fine allowing him to stay. But because I believe that when you're at the top, when you're the commander, when you're the chief, I do believe you should be held to a higher standard. And I don't want to happen to Honolulu what has happened in so many other American cities, where the public no longer trusts their police department. When that happens here, the criminal element wins.
And so what has to happen?
Well, right now, I think that the chief should temporarily step aside pending this criminal investigation against him here. Acknowledge here, it's just an investigation. It is not a criminal indictment. But because he's the chief and because integrity in the department is so important, I do believe he should temporarily step aside.
So that's a temporary situation. But in mm-hmm. terms of long-term police reform,
What
do you see happening?
I think Honolulu ought to take a look at what other American cities have done and looking at a police standards board, standardizing how we report police misconduct here. That is, right now, I think what's very good here is the trust between the police department and the public, I think, is still very strong and hasn't eroded as it has in other American cities like Baltimore or the worst out there is Ferguson, Missouri. But I don't want us to ever get to that place. And because I don't want us to get to that place, I think a new mayor has got to look at some of these new standards adopted by other American cities.
One final question, and we have to go in just a moment.
Sure.
But under issues on your website, you have a tab marked ethics. You already brought up the Ethics Commission. But in June, the head of the Ethics Commission, Chuck Tato, resigned, saying he was no longer able to be effective following the ongoing turmoil with the city. What's the future of the Ethics Commission, according to you, and does that include more authority?
Yeah, I'm, you know, Bethann, very quickly in background, you know, when I first got elected to the council, I was a very vigorous advocate for ethics reform. And Chuck Tato is an outstanding public servant. How he was railroaded out of that office by the mayor, I think, was wrong. We need to restore the trust of the Ethics Commission here. You know, I would like to see Chuck Tato come back here, and I'm going to work real, real hard to restore that sense of trust and integrity that has simply been lost in the current administration.
Does that mean more authority for the commission?
I think so. I think so. And less intervention and meddling by the mayor's office.
All right. Well, in the interest of time, we have to say goodbye
for
the moment.
No,
we'll be watching
problem.
This in the next 11 days. And thank you very much for
thank
the
you so much.
Morning.
And everybody out there, please don't forget to vote. Mahalo and aloha.
Charles DeJoux is a candidate for Honolulu mayor. He was previously a Hawaii state representative, a Hawaii city council member, and a U.S. representative for Hawaii's first congressional district. Tomorrow, we'll talk with a man who would like to keep his job, Honolulu Mayor Kirk Caldwell.
Today in the Backyard Quiz, we asked you to name the first rail line built in Hawaii. This particular train began operating in 1881, and it was not alone for long. In 1889, what would become Hawaii's longest railroad opened its doors. The Oahu Railway and Land Company laid tracks all the way from Kahuku to Wakiwa via Honolulu. Maui's Pioneer Mill opened a short-haul line in 1890, and on the Big Island, the Hilo Railroad opened a 33-mile line in 1899 that ran along the scenic Hamakua coast. But by the mid-1950s, most industrial railroads had been shuttered or converted to small tourist attractions, replaced by trucking, which was cheaper and required less infrastructure. Hawaii's first-ever rail line falls into that category. It was built on Kauai in 1881 for the Kilauea Plantation, but now goes by the name Kauai Plantation Railway.
And Diana Ocean knew that. She called us from Kaimuki and will be the recipient of an HPR T-shirt. Thank you very much for calling in and playing with us with the Backyard Quiz. If you've got a question for us, send it in to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from the College of Business at Hawaii Pacific University, whose MBA Flex Plus program offers a blend of classroom and online classes to fit the lives of working professionals. hpu.edu/business. Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Matson, whose employees and their ohana volunteer with local charities, including the American Heart Association's Heart Walk and the International Coastal Cleanup. Learn more at matson.com/foundation.
Aloha, this is Jose Fajardo, HPR's new general manager, with a special invitation for new members. On August 5th, it's $5 Friday here at HPR, and we're asking you to take five to show your support for this station with a contribution of $5 a month. Your sustaining membership will help ensure that HPR is there for you in the future. Save the date, $5 Friday, August 5th.
Bethann, you're getting an opportunity to hear from the mayoral candidates about the issues that they're most likely to be questioned about, rail, homelessness.
We're all getting a chance to hear a lot of that conversation. I'm glad for the extended conversations we've been able to have yesterday with Peter Carlisle, today with Charles DeJoux. Those will be on our archive very soon after this show wraps. And tomorrow we'll talk with Mayor Kirk Caldwell. But, I mean, in listening to Charles DeJoux today, if you're looking for a defining line, understanding that when, you know, we're also myopically trained on rail, he's saying very clearly that mass transit doesn't necessarily mean rail. So we're kind of back to that conversation again, and understanding that you know, we can't look at those words and just automatically go to rail.
Yeah.
He has a different idea about that. We'll see how that plays with what Mayor Caldwell has to say tomorrow. And we're also going to talk with Chelsea Wilson of rideshare company Lyft about the city and county's bill to regulate her company.
And we'll meet with the president of the Hawaii Harmonica Society.
We like to hear from you, and we have lots of ways for you to be in touch. We've got the talk back line. That number is 808-792-8217. We have email. That's talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can also post comments on Facebook. Our page is Hawaii Conversation. Or you can tweet us at HI Conversation or tweet me at VKOZHPR.
Past shows are archived under Talk Shows for the Conversation on HawaiiPublicRadio.org. I'm Chris Vandercook.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. We'll see you in the morning back here for more of The Conversation.
Horns return to the Atherton Studio on August 13th with a blues retrospective. They'll take you from earthy Chicago blues to sleek modern jazz.